It's 7:43 on this West Virginia morning. I'm Teresa Wills. This morning, we'll sit down with a hospice nurse to learn about end-of-life care.
I have a bag of ramps in my car right now. A patient wanted some ramps. I knew that would be the last time he got to eat ramps, so I went and dug some up.
We'll have that in just a moment. This is West Virginia Morning. I'm Teresa Wills. A multi-state commission charged with protecting the Ohio River gathered in Pittsburgh yesterday for the first of three public hearings. People were able to offer feedback about proposed changes to how some river pollutants are regulated. As Brittany Patterson reports, unanimous testimony asked commissioners to do more, not less.
This round of public comments is the latest in a multi-year effort to update the Commission's pollution control standards for the Ohio River. After thousands weighed in against it, the Ohio River Valley Water Sanitation Commission, or OSRSANCO, scrapped an industry-backed proposal in February that would have eliminated its pollution control standards altogether. A new proposal keeps the standards, but makes adoption by the eight states along the Ohio River optional. More than a dozen people testified that OSRSANCO should make adoption of the standards mandatory and should increase its pollution monitoring. Beaver County, Pennsylvania resident Terry Bumgardner lives 6 miles from Shell's ethane cracker, currently under construction on the banks of the Ohio River.
It seems to me that what's being proposed here is a move backwards when we need stronger protection, not less protection.
OSRSANCO is accepting public comment through April 15th. For the Ohio Valley Resource, I'm Brittany Patterson.
Flooding in the Midwest forced major ethanol plants making up a sixth of U.S. ethanol production to close or scale back production. Liam Nehemiah reports Ohio Valley ethanol producers still running are seeing a short-term boost because of that.
Mick Henderson runs the Commonwealth Agri-Energy ethanol plant in West Kentucky. He says the past year for U.S. ethanol producers, including in the Ohio Valley, has been rough.
We just passed our 15th anniversary, and this is going to be one of our weakest years.
Ethanol prices have been down the past year because supply of the grain-based fuel is at a record high. Retaliatory tariffs on corn from countries such as China have also hurt prices. Henderson says since flooding has shut down ethanol production farther west, Ohio Valley ethanol producers are seeing a short-term boost to their profits because they're making up for that lost supply. But he says the help is minimal.
If I were losing 10 cents a gallon, I'd be break even today.
Farmers who provide corn and grain to these ethanol plants, on the other hand, are generally protected against the ethanol industry's struggles. Three Rivers Energy Commodities manager Wade Sauerbry in East Ohio says ethanol prices can change quickly.
I think everybody's just playing it pretty close, you know, close to the vest here to see exactly what happens. You know, well, you get one tweet from somebody and there's a knee-jerk reaction in the market and you'll see a little bit of uptick.
Sauerbry says a priority for ethanol producers is a proposed Environmental Protection Agency rule to allow E15 fuel, a gasoline mix that uses more ethanol, to be sold year-round. The EPA is taking public comment on the rule through May. For the Ohio Valley Resource, I'm Liam Niemeyer.
In the next installment of our occasional series, Windows into Healthcare, health reporter Carol Lofton speaks with hospice nurse Lori Carter. Carter has been a hospice nurse for 20 years. She said for her and for many of the hospice nurses she knows, the work is a calling. In the interview, she says some of what she does is straight up nursing, managing pain, dressing wounds, and addressing symptoms of end stage disease. But the most subtle part of the job is helping families navigate one of the most intimate and emotional times of their lives.
For you, when you think about like hospice and the work that you do and being called to it, what does that mean exactly to you?
Just being with the patient and the family in the most emotional time of their life, helping them give each other that last act of love. I appreciate, and I feel honored that I am with that patient and that family during that time.
So some people, and I've heard especially in Appalachia, can have preconceived notions about what hospice is and what you actually do exactly. Explain to me what you do. What is it? What happens when you go into a home for the first time, and how does that relationship sort of form?
Well, depending on, you know, what is going on with the patient, you know, and how early or late in the disease trajectory that we get them, you know, you go in and you introduce yourself and, you know, you listen. The big thing is you listen. And you can find out, you know, if there is struggle already between what is happening with the patient and how the family is dealing with that. Of course, you know, we treat any symptoms that the patient has. I mean, my job, I feel, is the patient advocate and just trying to palliate those symptoms that they have and so that they are comfortable. I find out, you know, is there any things that they want to do before they die? You know, what are they able to do? And I try to facilitate that in any way that I can. I have a bag of ramps in my car right now that a patient wanted some ramps, you know. I knew that would be the last time he got to eat ramps, so I went and dug some up.
Some people think of hospice as giving up, so to speak. When you hear that, what is your reaction to that?
I think it's very sad. You know, we all are going to die. We all are. And, you know, normally the patients that we get, they have already fought for a very long time. This is the last act of love that you can give. And, you know, it's going to happen whether hospice is there or not. And they are most certainly not giving up. I mean, they're getting ready to go down a path that they've never been down either.
Has this work changed how you think about death?
It most certainly has. My family was not the type that, you know, went to funerals all the time and things. And I kind of came into hospice blind, really. And I quickly learned that it is a special experience. You have to believe that quality of life is better than quantity. And I tell you how I cope with things is I will walk into a home and I will look. There's always pictures on the walls of, you know, families. And I will look at those. I always do. And I can see what that patient looked like and how robust they were and how happy they were. And then I see the patient now. And that actually helps me know what I need to do and how I need to direct the family into what's happening, you know, where they are in this experience that they're getting ready to have.
One of the things I think is interesting about hearing conversations around hospice, especially from providers in hospice, is that we hear a lot about a nursing shortage and nursing turnover in hospitals. But hospice seems to have lower turnover rates, and people who become nurses in hospice tend to stay around despite being around death all the time, essentially. Why do you think that is?
I think it is a calling. I think you do realize that it's a special kind of nursing. You fall so much in love with what you do and the families and the patients. And I cannot imagine doing anything else. I don't think it is for every nurse. I don't. I think that you have a special belief and you want that special relationship with the patient and the family. I worked in the hospital, and some nurses think that's great, and that's wonderful for them. But I didn't feel, for me, that I could give the care and the personal care, maybe I should say, that I wanted to. I just didn't feel that I could do that. And with hospice, I can.
Does working with people at the end of life change how you live your life now?
It does. You know, I have heard so many times from patients, you know, I wish I would have done this or I wish I would have done that. I hear of their regrets. I see families and patients try to get over, you know, maybe they had been estranged, a child had been estranged from a parent, or, you know, a parent left, and now they're trying to make amends. I think that, you know, it's taught me that I need to ask for forgiveness, not to have regrets. Say what I need to say to my loved ones so that when that time comes, you won't have those regrets and those losses.
When you hear about things that people wish they had done, are there any themes that stand out to you that lots of people kind of have regrets at the end of life?
Oh, I think a lot of times it's, I should have took that trip. I shouldn't have worked so much. I should have spent more time with children or spouses. It's those types of things that, you know, they wish they would have done. Things that may happen in life and you really don't give it a second thought at the time, it seems to come back at the end of life. No matter how trivial it is, you remember, I should have said this or I should have done that. But hopefully, for the most part, I think, you know, they may say those things, but again, it's usually not big, huge things.
Over the last 20 years that you've been working in hospice, how has it changed?
Well, when I first started, no one knew what it was. And now it is more mainstream. I think people are more, they understand more what is happening. Death is not shunned like it used to be. You know, people talk about it more. Unfortunately, with our drug problem, it has caused some problems for us. I have to count pills every time I go. I have to watch neighbors coming over to visit. We have to find a place to put the medicine. It used to be able to sit beside the bed, but it can't do that anymore.
As more young people leave the state, are you seeing smaller family groups surrounding a patient at the end of life?
I am, and I'm seeing, you know, a lot of times it's the 90-year-old spouse trying to take care of the 90-year-old husband or wife. Family seems to live out of state a lot of times, and it has definitely caused some problems. Fortunately, we also have a long-term care team, and if the patient needs to be placed, they can still have hospice care. But there's definitely a lot of family that are not local anymore. And it you know, they're looking to hire caregivers. They might not be able to afford caregivers. In that case, we just try to ramp up our visits and try to pull in anyone that we can possibly pull in to assist that family.
That was health reporter Carol Lofton speaking with hospice nurse Lori Carter. Appalachia Health News is a project of West Virginia Public Broadcasting with support from Charleston Area Medical Center and Marshall Health. West Virginia Morning is a production of West Virginia Public Broadcasting, which is solely responsible for its content. You can keep up with the latest West Virginia news throughout the day on our website, wvpublic.org. Support for our news bureaus comes from West Virginia University, Concord University, and Shepherd University. Our producer is Glennis Board. I'm Teresa Wills.